with the utility, whereby the utility is now being paid for how much energy it can help its customers save rather than consume. I will explain this in detail in Chapter 12. The EESCs then come in and help you do that job. Just the other day, a salesman from General Electric's Energy Efficiency Service Company came to your door. Your home is 20 years old. The General Electric EESC man offered this deal. First, for free, they would give your whole house an efficiency checkup. They would bring in equipment to pressurize your entire home and show you where all the heat and air conditioning was leaking from ducts that had not been connected properly and therefore were just warming the crawl spaces, much to the enjoyment of the mice. Then they would borrow the money to pay for sealing all the leaks in the ducts and fissures in your roof that had been silently draining energy from your house and raising your monthly bills by 30%. They would also install more energy-efficient appliances. You don't need to put down any money up front. The EESC would share with you the money you saved on your monthly electric and gas bills and the money the EESC would earn from selling the carbon credits on the global market for reducing your carbon footprint. The General Electric EESC takes 75% of the savings, using 50% to pay off the loan, and keeps 25% as profit. And you get the other 25% savings. Your home is now more energy efficient and has a higher resale value. Meanwhile, the Sears EESC just dropped off a pamphlet offering you the same deal with a 60-40 split. Because the cash flow from all these efficiency deals is very predictable, the EESCs can sell them to investment banks, which turn them into green savings bonds. After you showered and ate breakfast, you decided to head for the office for your first meeting. This involved taking a short walk, about 20 paces, down the hall to your home office, holding your smart card in your hand. Your smart card, which is sponsored by Visa and United Airlines Mileage Plus, looks just like a credit card, only slightly thicker. You start your workday by putting it into the docking bay of the Sun Ray Terminal, made by Sun Microsystems, on your home office desk. That Sun Ray Terminal uses only 4 watts compared to 50 watts or more in your standard PC. The reason is that there is no hard drive sucking up energy. The Sun Ray Terminal is just a screen with a slot beneath it. But as soon as you put the smart card into the slot, it connects you to the network cloud where all your software programs, email, internet applications, and personal files are located. The cloud is a data center packed with servers that is located close to a dam on the Columbia River, which is providing it with clean hydropower to run all your programs and those of millions of other people, and to cool all those servers. The smart lights in your office, triggered by motion sensors, went on as soon as you walked into the room, as did the air conditioner. No electricity is consumed in the room when you are not there. Every device, every new home, and every new building is now built with rising efficiency standards from day one. In the 2007 energy bill, President George W. Bush effectively outlawed the Edison incandescent light bulb, phasing it out by 2014 because it converts 90% of its energy into wasted heat, which we all noticed when we burned our fingers trying to remove a bulb before it cooled down. It has been replaced by a smart, compact fluorescent. With 1/4 the electricity consumption, it not only reduces the energy required to produce light, but also reduces the energy required to cool your office, which was being warmed by the excess heat emanating from all your incandescent bulbs. On your desk, next to the Sun Ray Terminal, you have a 6-watt desk lamp. That's right, only 6 watts, because this lamp uses a light-emitting diode and little mirrors to give you intense, focused light, the equivalent of 100 watts, but at 6% of the energy use. The same is true for the appliances throughout your house. Your refrigerator is so efficient that it represents the electricity equivalent of a 20-watt light bulb. Your television, TiVo unit, and treadmill all shut down completely, no longer draining power when not in use. Normally, your company encourages you to work from home as much as possible. But today, on the Sunray terminal, you found a message from your boss saying that a teleconference would be held downtown at 10:30 a.m. between your management team and your colleagues in Chennai, India, where your company is involved in a huge real estate development. At 9:45 a.m., you get into your Ford Mustang Resu. It is a plug-in hybrid electric that gets the equivalent of 100 miles per gallon. Plug-in hybrid electric vehicles are like regular hybrids, but with larger batteries and the ability to recharge from a wall outlet. As a result, all your local travel is electric, but you always have a gas tank backup. The battery is charged every night, or whenever it needs juice, and, like your dryer and other appliances, automatically interacts with your electric utility to buy the lowest-cost electrons available during the depths of nighttime off-peak hours. As you set out to the office, the GPS map in the car flashed a message that there was an accident on the highway that you normally use to get to the office and proposed an alternative route. To enter into the downtown area, you had to pass through an electronic gateway, which automatically charged you $12 for entering the city between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. It costs $18 at rush hour. This is another reason you work from home as often as you can, carpool, or take the bus to work. It's all part of the new congestion pricing system that has dramatically reduced the number of cars coming into the city and thereby created more room for electric buses and other forms of mass transit, which can now take more people to more places faster than ever before. Your city's new mayor actually won the election with the motto, "Price the road and clear the traffic." "You don't need to be a rocket scientist," said the mayor. "If you want fewer CO2 emitters, charge people money for emitting CO2. If you want fewer cars on the roads during certain hours, charge people money for using them." It works everywhere it has been tried. When you arrived at the office, you docked your car at a parking ramp where you can both charge your car battery and sell electricity into the grid. There is a universal two-way plug in every home and parking lot in America now. You decided to park at this ramp after it won a bidding contest against the parking ramp around the corner. These bidding contests between parking ramp owners are now very common. Your ramp won by throwing in 4 free parking days a month and a car wash every Friday. Why does the ramp owner want you to park there so badly? Because you will be sharing with him the money you earn from selling extra electrons back to the grid. The entire roof of the parking ramp consists of solar panels that create clean electrons, which are then sold to the batteries of all the cars on the ramp. The owner calls it e-gasoline. The parking lot's name is Bill's Artificial Oil Field. So the lot owner is both in the parking and the energy-generating business. At 2:32 p.m., when the temperature hits 87 degrees, your car, which still had most of its electrons from last night's charge, made a calculation that energy prices had moved up on the smart grid to a point where it was time to sell some electrons. Your smart car calculated how many electrons you would need to drive to your normal Wednesday after-work chores, to take the kids to soccer practice, and stop at the grocery store, and saved 10% more just in case you altered your routine. Then it put a sell bid of 40 cents a kilowatt hour out to the utility. SoCalEd bought 5 kilowatt hours off your car battery through the universal plug. This helped the utility meet its peak load demand and keep its load profile flat, while you and the garage owner both made money. In this case, you made $2. The parking lot operator, who provided the solar panels and the plug connecting your car to the grid, also got a small cut of that. So far this month, your car battery has earned you $24 selling and buffering electricity. At the same time, it cost you only $47 this month to charge your car with electricity, because you were usually charging at home at night at low off-peak rates and selling it during the day at peak rates. It means you are driving for the equivalent of about $1.50 per gallon. People still drive less and use more mass transit because congestion pricing, which funds better mass transit, induces them to do so rather than high oil prices that fund petro-dictators. While at the office, your boss gathered together the entire management team responsible for designing smart housing for a new suburb in Chennai. You met with your 6 Indian counterparts in Chennai for 3 hours to go over everything from financing to architectural problems. Once, such business would have had to be conducted face-to-face, with at least some of you flying over to Chennai, expending considerable time, money, and energy. Not anymore. This 3-hour meeting was held virtually through Cisco Systems' telepresence system over the Cisco network, in which your team sat in a studio and the other team was vividly illustrated on a wall-sized TV screen in 3D. The Cisco telepresence makes people look and sound just like they do in person, offering life-size images of each meeting participant, high-definition video, and spatial audio, which creates the dynamic of voices coming directly from the participants. It is so realistic, you all felt as if you were at the same table in the same room, even though you were half a world apart. In fact, it was all so realistic, and the images so life-size, that when the meeting ended, you got up and tried to shake hands with someone on the screen, eliciting laughter all around. After the meeting, you returned home and docked your car back in the garage around 4 p.m. As you were mowing the lawn with your all-electric mower, your kids came home on their hybrid electric school bus, just another big rolling energy storage unit that actually makes money for the school district by storing and selling clean electrons the way you do. The neighborhood school is now a dual-use education and commercial center, a DUECC. That is, the school kitchen, as soon as it is finished serving lunch, is taken over by Einstein Brothers Bagels. Instead of building their own new bakery, the bagel company uses the school's kitchens from 3 p.m. until 6 a.m. the next morning to bake bagels and deliver them to their outlets and grocery stores throughout the city. Dual using has become a huge trend, saving enormous amounts of electricity, land, and new construction, and, by the way, earning the school extra cash to hire more teachers. Domino's Pizza also uses idle school kitchens during after-lunch hours for making and delivering pizzas throughout the city. Domino's has not leased or built a new commercial kitchen in years. The school is also a net zero building. It was designed and built so that all the parts, walls, windows, the lighting system, the water handling system, the air handling system, are both individually and collectively super energy efficient. At the same time, the external roof and walls of the school building are a mini utility, a combination of solar panels, solar thermal generation, and passive lighting through smart windows that let maximum light in during the day to replace bulbs. As a result, during working hours, the school is a net energy producer, and it sells its excess electrons into the grid. At night, when Einstein is cooking the next day's bagels in the kitchen, the school buys whatever electricity it needs from the grid at low, off-peak rates. At the end of each month, its utility bill reads net zero. You cannot get a building permit in your city any longer unless your building is energy net zero. Why are net zero buildings and dual use such a big deal? Well, here's a fun fact. The production of cement worldwide, the heat that has to be generated to roast the limestone, and the CO2 that is emitted in the process, releases almost as much CO2 into the atmosphere as all the passenger cars in the world. So just throwing up dumb cement buildings is a huge energy drain and carbon dioxide generator. Once we realized how much of both we could save from smarter cars and smarter buildings, building standards became as important as mileage standards. I am sure that what I have just described sounds far-fetched, like something out of a Jetsons cartoon or a science fiction novel. Well, it's not fetched from very far. A simple prototype of this energy internet was deployed in 2007 in Washington State's Olympic Peninsula in an experiment organized by the Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in partnership with the Bonneville Power Administration and local utilities. On November 26, 2007, MSNBC ran a story about the preliminary results, headlined "Smart Appliances Learning to Save Power Grid." The story noted that, as part of the experiment, the researchers found that they could cut the peak electricity load among participating homes by half for 3 days in a row. It quoted Rob Pratt, the lab's program manager for a multi-agency collaboration dubbed GridWise, as saying, "That was astounding." One homeowner, Jerry Brouse of Squim, Washington, who signed up for the program as soon as he heard about it on a local radio station, said that his electricity load dropped by 15%, and he compiled his own Excel spreadsheet to determine the percentage of power flowing to his water heater, heat pump, and dryer to pinpoint how he might save even more. He also received quarterly checks from the program reflecting his savings, including a recent one for $37. During several camping trips, Browse could tell his house to go to sleep or wake up simply by logging into an internet site and remotely turning his heat and hot water heater on or off. The article explained that in the Browse household and others throughout Washington's Olympic Peninsula, smart water heaters and thermostats provided updated electric prices about every 5 minutes, depending on what was available and needed. Homeowners could adjust their settings to decrease power consumption and save money during peak demand, or override the controls at any point, like when they were hosting dinner guests or a fussy relative. Richard Kotzev, an expert on social and environmental behavior and president of Portland, Oregon-based Public Policy Research, said merely providing more information to consumers would be ineffective without also giving them incentives to act. Homeowners will readily accept money-saving devices that require fairly easy lifestyle adjustments, he said, like delaying a dishwasher or dryer run to obtain cheaper rates. The article went on to say that researchers spent an average of $1,000 on appliances, equipment, and monitoring capabilities for each of the roughly 200 homes participating in two related studies. But for more widespread and routine residential use, he expects the upfront costs to run about $400 to $500 and potentially less if computer chips can be built into the appliances before they leave the factory. If this becomes cheap enough, even your coffee maker can help the grid out, Pratt said. And if eventually adopted throughout the country, the energy-saving appliances could translate into savings of about $70 billion in new power plant construction and power distribution costs over 20 years. Speaking of coffee makers helping out the grid, Pratt and his colleagues Mike Davis and Carl Imhoff at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland, Washington, gave me a demonstration when I visited them. They took me into a room that is set up like a home kitchen laundry room with a washer, dryer, water heater, refrigerator, and coffee maker. Each device was outfitted with a special chip designed at PNNL. It is called a grid-friendly appliance controller, or GFA. This grid-friendly controller is a 2x2.5-inch circuit board that can be installed in refrigerators, air conditioners, water heaters, and various other household appliances. It monitors the power grid and turns appliances off for a few seconds to a few minutes without ruining the appliance in response to power grid overload or commands. When power plants cannot generate enough power to meet customer needs, grid-friendly appliances reduce some of the load on the system to balance supply and demand. So when I came into the mock kitchen, they had everything running, including the refrigerator with the door open. On a digital overhead display, they had a readout showing how many kilowatts all the appliances were using at full blast. It was very noisy. Then they dropped the electricity into the kitchen by 70%. What was amazing was that all the devices appeared to continue to run, making almost the same amount of noise, but they were using 70% less electricity. How? The grid-friendly appliances sensed the power dip and reacted by cutting off portions of their load. For instance, the dryer turned off the heating element but kept the drum turning. The hot water heater's heating element went off, but there was enough hot water stored in the tank that if you were in the shower, you never would have known. In the refrigerator, the defrost cycle was interrupted, but if you opened the door, the light remained on, and your food would easily have stayed cold for the 2 or 3 minutes in which the grid was under stress and the power got dialed down. These grid-friendly circuits cost only $25 per appliance, and the price would surely plummet with mass production. The beauty of this technology, which is now being pilot tested in bigger communities, is severalfold. First, these sorts of power dips happen on your grid a few times a week. You just don't know it, and the reason you don't know it is because your utility protects against it by having a spare power plant or two spinning all the time, even when they are not producing electricity, so that its power can be drawn upon instantly whenever there is a dip. That is called reserve requirement. And if the reserve plant is a coal plant, it is spitting out CO2 just so you don't experience a dip. If we could manage these dips by controlling demand, just dialing down appliances rather than always adding extra supply, we could save energy and money and cut back CO2 emissions. From the beginning of the grid, we have tried to solve every problem from the supply side with new technology. We've never been able to do it from the demand side with new technology, said Mike Davis, the associate director for PNNL's Energy Science and Technology Directorate. Now we have the technology to do it. If someone wants to turn off the heating element in my coffee pot for a couple minutes every day and do it with millions of other homes so we don't have to have extra coal-fired power plants, I'm good with that. The model that I envisaged previously, and the model that Davis and his colleagues tested out, would involve a revolutionary change to the utilities industry. Utilities, instead of limiting their vision from the power plant to your home electricity meter, would be wholly transformed. Their universe would stretch from the generation of clean power on one end right into your home appliances, your car battery, and even the solar panels on your roof. Rather than just being a seller of dumb and dirty electrons, it would be an enabler of this whole smart grid energy internet. And it would make its money from optimizing this system. Jim Rogers, the CEO of Duke Energy, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, likes to say that rather than spend $7 billion on building a new nuclear plant, he would rather the regulators let him spend that same amount of money building out a smart transmission grid and helping his customers to install solar panels on their roofs, smart black boxes in their homes, smart batteries in their cars, and grid-friendly chips in their appliances, and then have Duke Energy maintain and service every aspect of that network. For 100 years, we defined the boundaries of our market as being from the generator to the meter on the wall outside your house, said Rogers. Going forward, I want that market to be from the generator to our customers' rooftops and to the energy applications and energy networks embedded in our customers' homes and offices and cars. That is where the real savings will come, from optimizing those energy networks and applications. I have to take my grid and make it smart and make everyone's home into a smart home and everyone's factory into a smart factory and then optimize them all so everyone gets the most service for the least money and least amount of CO2. That would be a very different job for utilities, from running an all-you-can-eat for $5 electron buffet to optimizing an energy internet. But that is the future. And as Jeff Wacker, the EDS strategist, likes to say, the future is with us, it's just not widely distributed yet. He is right in the sense that we can see today what the future could look like. We can see the technologies taking shape that could make it happen, but we still need a few key breakthroughs to get that future widely distributed. The energy internet I've described, if we can get it built, has the potential to give us more growth with fewer power plants, better energy efficiency, and more renewable energy like wind and solar by smoothing out the peaks and valleys in energy demand. If we could just add another breakthrough on top of that, inventing a source of energy that would give us abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons to power this energy internet, and that would dramatically reduce our usage of coal, oil, and natural gas, the revolution would be complete. Then you would be feeding clean electrons into an energy-saving smart grid, into a smart home, and into a smart car. That, when it happens, will be the great energy transformation. It will be like two giant rivers coming together, the IT revolution and the ET revolution. And when it happens, when it really happens, it will unlock more human potential, more innovation, more possibilities to lift people out of poverty in a sustainable way than you can possibly imagine. I just want to live long enough to see that day dawn. The next chapters describe how we can make it happen. Chapter 11. The Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. Recently, reports have been current in certain newspapers that Mr. Thomas A. Edison, the inventor, has at last perfected the storage battery, and that within a few months, electrically propelled vehicles, costing little to buy and next to nothing to maintain, will be on the market. The same story has appeared regularly for years, and yet matters do not appear to have advanced much. International Herald Tribune, November 1, 1907. If I'd asked my customers what they wanted, they'd have said, a faster horse. Henry Ford. The city of Tianjin, China, is home to many of China's big automakers, and in September 2007, I was invited to speak at the China Green Car Congress there. Yes, China, which has been steadily improving its own auto mileage and pollution standards, now holds a conference to talk about the latest in green car technologies. Who knew? The venue was the Marriott in Tianjin, and the audience was mostly Chinese auto industry executives, some pretty tough-looking car guys, who listened to my remarks via translation on headphones. I thought hard and long beforehand about what to say to this group that might stimulate their thinking and give them a perspective they hadn't heard before. In the end, I decided to go right for the jugular. The basic thrust of my talk was as follows. Every year I come to China, and young Chinese tell me, Mr. Friedman, you Americans got to grow dirty for 150 years. You got to have your industrial revolution based on coal and oil. Now it is our turn. Well, on behalf of all Americans, I am here today to tell you that you're right. It's your turn. Please, take your time. Grow as dirty as you like for as long as you like. Take your time, please. Because I think my country needs only 5 years to invent all the clean power and energy efficiency tools that you, China, will need to avoid choking on pollution. And then we are going to come over and sell them all to you. We will get at least a 5-year jump on you in the next great global industry. Clean power and energy efficiency. We will totally dominate you in those industries. So please, don't rush. Grow as dirty as you like for as long as you want. If you want to do it for 5 more years, that's great. If you want to give us a 10-year lead on the next great global industry, that would be even better. Please, take your time. At first, I could see a lot of these grizzled Chinese car guys adjusting their earpieces to make sure that they were hearing me right. What the hell did he just say? America is going to clean our clock in the next great global industry? What industry is that? But as I went on, I could also see some heads nodding and some wry smiles of recognition from those who got my point. Clean power is going to be the global standard over the next decade, and clean power tools are going to be the next great global industry, and the countries who make more of them and sell more of them will have a competitive advantage. Those countries will have both the cleanest air and the fastest growing businesses. Not a bad combination. That is the point I was trying to drive home in Tianjin, by making it into a competitive issue. The longer China focuses on getting its share from a world that no longer exists, a world in which people could use dirty fuels with impunity, and the longer it postpones imposing the policies, prices, and regulations on itself that will stimulate a clean power industry at scale, the happier I am as an American. America wins. America wins. America wins. If only our country understood this moment and was doing everything it could to put in place the winning formula, an REEFIGDCPEERPC is less than TTCOBCOG, a renewable energy ecosystem for innovating, generating, and deploying clean power. Energy efficiency, resource productivity, and conservation is less than the true cost of burning coal, oil, and gas. Then we really would be able to clean China's clock. But we don't understand this moment and we're not doing all we can, which is why China could still end up cleaning ours. The energy internet I described in the previous chapter would be at the core of such a revolutionary new clean power system. That smart grid is vitally necessary to drive energy efficiency, to reduce demand, and to reduce emissions, but it alone is not sufficient. We also need abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons to feed into that smart grid and create a complete clean energy system, from the power plant to the transmission line to your home and business to your car. Unfortunately, as noted earlier, we have not found that magic bullet, that form of energy production that will give us abundant, clean, reliable, cheap electrons. All the advances we have made so far in wind, solar, geothermal, solar thermal, hydrogen, and cellulosic ethanol are incremental, and there has been no breakthrough in any other energy source. Incremental breakthroughs are all we've had, but exponential is what we desperately need. That is why the Green Revolution is first and foremost an innovation challenge, not a regulation challenge. Ultimately, this problem is going to have to be solved by the engineers, said Craig Mundy, Microsoft's Chief Research and Strategy Officer. But how could it be that, with all the green talk and all the green hype, we have not made such an exponential innovation engineering breakthrough yet? The answer is twofold. First, real energy innovation is hard. We are bumping up against the current limits of physics, chemistry, thermodynamics, nanotechnology, and biology, and we need to push out the frontiers in each of these disciplines. But second, more important, and the subject of this chapter and the next, we haven't really tried. That's right, we haven't really tried. We have not put in place the basic requirement for trying, a coordinated set of policies, tax incentives and disincentives, and regulations that would stimulate the marketplace to produce an energy internet, to move the clean power technologies we already have, like wind and solar, down the learning curve much faster, and to spur the massive, no-holds-barred, everybody-in-their-garage-or-laboratory innovation we need for new sources of clean electrons. I cannot stress this point enough. If you take only one thing away from this program, please take this. We are not going to regulate our way out of the problems of the energy climate era. We can only innovate our way out, and the only way to do that is to mobilize the most effective and prolific system for transformational innovation and commercialization of new products ever created on the face of the earth, the U.S. marketplace. There is only one thing bigger than Mother Nature, and that is Father Prophet, and we have not even begun to enlist him in this struggle. We don't need a Manhattan Project for clean energy. We need a market for clean energy. That's what we're missing. We don't need a secret government-led initiative involving a dozen scientists in a remote hideaway to come up with a single invention. We need 10,000 innovators all collaborating with and building upon one another to produce all sorts of breakthroughs in abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons and energy efficiency. And we need to create demand, huge demand, crazy, wild, off-the-charts demand for existing clean power technologies like wind and solar in order to reduce the cost of these technologies and make them competitive with conventional fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. We could make these already existing clean power technologies so much cheaper and so much more effective today if we created the market pull that would demand their mass production all over the country. They would move quickly down the learning curve. We could do for solar and wind what China did for tennis shoes and toys. But the only thing that can stimulate this much innovation in new technologies and the radical improvement of existing ones is the free market. Only the market can generate and allocate enough capital fast enough and efficiently enough to get 10,000 inventors working in 10,000 companies and 10,000 garages and 10,000 laboratories to drive transformational breakthroughs. Only the market can then commercialize the best of them and improve on the existing ones at the scope, speed, and scale we need. But markets are not just open fields to which you simply add water and then sit back in a lawn chair, watch whatever randomly sprouts, and assume that the best outcome will always result. No, markets are like gardens. You have to intelligently design and fertilize them, with the right taxes, regulations, incentives, and disincentives, so they yield the good, healthy crops necessary for you to thrive. Up to now, we have not designed our energy garden to get the maximum amount of innovation in clean power. Not at all. To the extent that we have designed it, we have designed it to produce energy from cheap, dirty fuels, primarily from oil, coal, and natural gas. And then we sat back and let all those in Congress and the private sector who benefited from the use of those fuels to water and fertilize this garden like crazy with government supports, while paying scant attention to everything else. There has been only one rule in our energy garden. It was, to use a term coined by the British economist Paul Collier, survival of the fattest. Those with the biggest lobbies and deepest pockets make policy. Now, our energy garden is overrun with a tangle of coal, oil, and natural gas pipelines, refineries, and gas stations, and it is very hard for anything new to grow there without getting choked. Have no doubt, our garden has been designed by the oil, coal, and natural gas interests to suit their needs, to keep these fuels cheap and abundant and difficult to supplant. And the global garden has been designed by the OPEC oil cartel and the petro-dictators to suit their interests, too. There is no free market in energy where everyone is competing on a level playing field. That is a complete fantasy. In what free market would you find the U.S. government slapping a 54-cent a gallon tariff on sugarcane ethanol imported from Brazil, a democratic ally of the United States, while imposing only a 1.25 cent a gallon tariff on crude oil imported from Saudi Arabia, the home of most of the 9/11 hijackers? Only in a market where the American corn lobby has enough clout in Congress to prevent Brazilian sugar ethanol from competing with American corn ethanol, even though sugar ethanol packs 7 or 8 times more energy, and only in an America where at least some elements of the big oil lobby are so bent on keeping us dependent on gasoline for transportation fuels that they always want to make it difficult for any alternatives to undercut them on price. In what free market would we give billions in permanent or long-term tax incentives to the oil, coal, and gas industries, but stop and start every 2 or 3 years for 3 decades the puny tax breaks for wind and solar power, making long-term investing in these areas very precarious? Only in a market designed to keep fossil fuels cheap and renewables expensive and elusive. No wonder that, as my New York Times colleague Jad Mouawad wrote November 9, 2007, when oil was approaching $100 a barrel, even at today's highs, oil is cheaper than imported bottled water, which would cost $180 a barrel, or milk, at $150 a barrel. You are not going to get energy innovation at scale when a barrel of oil is cheaper than a barrel of water or a barrel of milk. If we want to see the innovation we need in clean electrons, smart grids, and energy efficiency, we need to intelligently redesign the garden, i.e., the market. When it comes to developing the next generation of clean power, I don't believe in evolution. I only believe in intelligent design, says Amos Avedon, a principal vice president of Bechtel Corporation and an expert on building big power systems. We need intelligently designed policies to give us the best chance possible to produce the breakthroughs we need. People often ask me, "What's your favorite renewable energy? Are you a solar photovoltaic guy? A wind guy? A geothermal guy? A solar thermal guy?" My answer today is very simple. My favorite renewable energy is an ecosystem for energy innovation. I'm an ecosystem for innovation guy. That's what we need above all else, an intelligently designed system of policies, tax incentives and disincentives, and regulations that will get every promising source of clean electrons and energy efficiency that we already have down the learning curve faster, and will move every new idea for generating clean electrons out the lab door quicker. Only that kind of ecosystem for innovation can give birth to an energy internet smart grid, fed by abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons. It takes a system to make a system. We don't need the government to be launching a Manhattan Project. We need the government to be stimulating exponential innovation by reshaping the market, said Kurt Carlson, the president and CEO of SRI, the Silicon Valley research firm, and co-author of Innovation, the Five Disciplines for Creating What Customers Want. If the government just did the reasonable things, the rest would come into place. Many other major industrial countries in the free world seem to understand this and have begun to take at least some intelligently designed steps to promote energy and environmental innovation and deployment. America has not kept pace. The only thing we have an industrial policy in place for in this country is agriculture, a 19th century industry, Carlson added. We certainly don't have an intelligently designed national strategy for energy innovation and commercialization. We don't want government to be picking the winners, added Carlson. That is how we got too deep into corn ethanol. We want government setting the right tax policies, regulatory policies, and education policies, and funding the basic research that pushes out the boundaries of material science, chemistry, physics, biology, and nanotechnology, preparing all the soil so the market and venture capitalists can pick off whichever sprouts look most likely to make the difficult transition from drawing board to marketplace. That's what intelligent design is all about. In the short term, a transformational breakthrough is unlikely, said Carlson. But in the long term, if we do the right things, clean energy is a very solvable problem that will put the world in a better place. But it is not going to happen with an unintelligent design. This chapter will look at the price signals that would have to be part of such an intelligently designed system. Before I go into what sort of price signal we need, though, let me underscore for a moment just how feeble the American system has been during the last 50 years when it comes to stimulating clean energy innovation. Let's start with a statistic. The total investment in research and development by electric utilities in the United States in 2007 was about 0.15% of total revenues. In most competitive industries, the figure is 8 to 10%. If your total investment in R&D is 0.15% of revenues, that's not going to buy you much more than a few subscriptions to Popular Mechanics and Scientific American. In fact, the American pet food industry spends more each year on R&D than the American utilities industry does. Another way to underscore this point is with a question. When was the last big breakthrough in clean energy production in the United States? Answer, 1957, with the opening of the world's first central station commercial nuclear reactor located in Shippingport, Pennsylvania. That's right, we have not had a scale breakthrough in clean energy since the days of filterless cigarettes and segregation. Still looking for more proof of how uninnovative we've been in the energy field? Ask Jeffrey Immelt, chairman and CEO of General Electric, one of the world's premier manufacturers of power systems. He told me the following story. He has worked for General Electric for 26 years. In those 26 years, he has seen 8 or 9 generations of innovation in medical technology in GE's healthcare business, in devices like X-ray equipment, MRIs, or CAT scans, because the government and the healthcare market created prices, incentives, and competition that drove a constant flow of invention. It was very profitable to innovate in this field and fairly easy to jump in. But in power, said Immelt, one generation of real innovation is all that he has seen. Today, on the power side, said the GE chairman, we're still selling the same basic coal-fired power plants we had when I arrived. They're a little cleaner and more efficient now, but basically the same model. 9 generations of innovation in healthcare, 1 in power systems. What does that tell you? It tells you that you have a market that simply has not been shaped to produce clean energy innovation. You can't look back at the last 30 years, concluded Immelt, and say that the market in energy has worked. Between regulated electricity and gas utilities that operate in a monopoly environment and oil companies who had a tacit monopoly over transportation fuels, the key players in the energy market had little incentive to innovate, and the new startups had little room to emerge. Energy fundamentally has been underinvested in from the technology standpoint, said Immelt. The healthcare industry basically puts about 8% of revenue back into R&D every year, and the entire energy industry puts about 2% back into R&D every year. Edward Goldberg, president of Anisa Group, business consultants, and adjunct professor at the Zicklin School of Business at Baruch College of the City University of New York, told the story in a succinct little essay he published in the Baltimore Sun, February 23, 2007. Modern American capitalism, he noted, is the world's envy of growth. It successfully harnesses the human drive for competitiveness with the human need to create and innovate. Apple booms with the iPod, and Microsoft works day and night to create a better version. But when competition becomes muted and market innovation is deemed not essential, the cornucopia that we call today's capitalism stalls, and society is harmed. This is exactly what has happened within our energy giants. The most efficient way of developing new energy resources should be through private enterprise. But our major energy companies have not been pressured by the forces of modern market capitalism to give anything but lip service to the development of new energy sources. While capitalism in America is constantly evolving, creating more efficiencies and innovations, the energy industry appears to be stuck in a mercantilistic mode. If this occurred in a small industry, few people would really care. But when the market becomes complacent in its role of innovator in our most vital industry, the government, as the guardian of our nation's independence, must become the catalyst for innovation. In the energy industry, the need to compete for consumers, and thus to innovate, has not been an obligation for years. When was the last time anyone has seen an oil company advertising on TV that its products or services were better than the competition's? Although not monopolies, the energy companies are in effect large, privately owned utilities and delivery systems. Under the premise that energy is so important to the nation that it must be treated differently, these companies are supported, unlike any other industry, with massive American military investments to protect their supply lines and sourcing. Unlike modern high-tech companies, energy companies are free to ignore Harvard business professor Clayton Christensen's maxim of disruptive technologies, that new technologies replace existing ones because they are cheaper and more consumer-friendly. Able to disregard this need to create newness in the marketplace, energy companies primarily invest in growing and maintaining their supply systems. Without market pressure to innovate to find alternative sources of energy, society receives a much reduced benefit from the existence of these companies. If Toyota takes market share from Ford by manufacturing hybrids, while Ford is still making SUVs, Ford is punished by the market. But because they derive most of their profits from sourcing, the energy companies do not need competitive innovation to survive. And because their profits have been extraordinary, they are not punished by the market for a lack of innovation. In fact, they are rewarded, while at the same time, they are at liberty to ignore the market-driven changes that have moved American capitalism forward. The energy majors know that if oil, year in and year out, remains cheaper than competitive energy products, there will be little pressure to invest in new forms of energy. And when the oil market falls, it reinforces this corporate stagnation. In a world of energy shortages, America no longer can afford the luxury of allowing old-fashioned, non-innovative capitalism to be at the heart of its industrial system, distorting and threatening the system as a whole. The only way to change this situation and set off the forest fire of innovation in energy that we need is by reshaping the market in a way that will make it much easier for clean power technologies to compete and challenge the incumbent dirty fuels. And the only way to do that is with taxes and incentives that will stimulate more demand for the clean power technologies that already exist, like wind and solar, and pull them down the learning curve to the chindia price, with taxes and incentives that will stimulate more research and development by private companies and universities, and with taxes and incentives that will encourage more investors to quickly commercialize any breakthroughs that government or university or private sector labs might produce. No matter how much you tell the market what you want it to do, it is the price signal that markets respond to, said Dan Kamen, the University of California, Berkeley, expert on energy innovation. Therefore, anyone who invokes markets and doesn't want to invoke a price signal failed Econ 101. We invoke the market in energy, but we don't use it. If you want a market to produce something and there is no price signal, you don't have a market. You have to have a price signal. Prices and innovation. The person who best expressed the critical importance that relative prices play in stimulating innovation in renewable energy was none other than the late, great Saudi Arabian oil minister, Sheikh Ahmed Zaki Yamani. Back in the 1970s, as OPEC was just starting to feel its oats, Yamani used to warn his colleagues not to raise oil prices too high, too fast, for fear of causing a government and market reaction in the West that would trigger massive innovation in wind, solar, and other forms of renewable energy. The way Yamani put it to his OPEC colleagues reportedly went something like this. Remember, boys, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. It ended because people invented alternative tools made of bronze and then iron. Yamani knew that if the oil-consuming countries actually got their acts together to produce renewable energy at scale or to drive energy efficiency breakthroughs exponentially higher, the oil age would end with millions of barrels of oil still underground.